O'Shaughnessy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Today, we're going to talk a little bit about the Medicaid Management Information System and the new version that's being developed by the Department of Health and Human Services. I'll talk first very briefly and just provide a high-level overview, provide some background, and then Angie Sly from the Department of Health and Human Services, who's the actual director of the program, will talk about the specifics related to their current effort. Basically, what I plan to do today is start out and talk big picture about how individual IT projects work and what you look for in a successful project to kind of give everyone a sense for what the major issues are when you're developing a new system. From there, I intend to provide some background on MMIS in general and then talk about what's gone on in North Carolina. In this month's Harvard Business Review, there is a global study of IT initiatives that's one of the largest ones ever conducted, and they looked at almost 1,500 projects, and they compared budgets and benefits to the actual costs and results that the projects achieved, and looked at both public and private. A lot of them were in the U.S., but they also looked at efforts throughout the world, and some of their results were interesting. The average cost overrun for a project was 27%. So in the IT world, there tend to be issues with cost estimates for what a project's going to cost. But they determined that averaging projects is really not the best way to determine if a project has issues, because they identified what they referred to as black swans. One out of six projects that they looked at, and this is out of 1,500 projects, had an average cost overrun of 200% and a schedule overrun of almost 70%. So basically their bottom line is you've got to look at projects individually and evaluate where a specific project is and what its issues are. But based on this study they did, they came up with some criteria for a successful IT project, and this is something that y'all can use to kind of gauge where MMIS is. Schedule obviously is very important, because as a project's delayed, it tends to become more expensive, and you also see scope creep, which is another thing that they mentioned was an issue. You've got to keep the project focused on its original scope and not allow it to expand as much as possible. Breaking the project into pieces was another way that projects were made more successful. Instead of taking a huge project that might be hundreds of millions of dollars, or in some case even billions, what they discovered was if you break it into manageable pieces, you're more likely to be successful. Assembling the right team obviously would be very important, but in addition to that, ensuring that you don't have turnover among the members of the team, because one of the issues with IT projects is they require both subject matter expertise and expertise in information technology. So when you lose people, in many instances, you have to start over, so you lose time. It's very important in any IT project that it be looked at as a business initiative, not as an IT initiative. Information technology exists to support the particular business of the organization or agency. And so that's something that you've got to look at if you're trying to determine if an IT project is going to be successful. And finally, you have to focus on readiness to go live, because that's the most important thing, is getting to the end of the project and being able to operate. Now, one thing that North Carolina currently has that helps with this final bullet is the Office of Information Technology Services maintains a database that they call the Project Portfolio Management Tool, and it tracks all of these projects month by month. And so they're constantly looking at where they are and comparing them and ensuring and looking to see if they're maintaining their schedule and if they're going to be ready to go live on time. So we're talking about MMIS, Medicaid Management Information System. So what is it? Basically, this is the federal definition, and as Ms. Sly goes through her presentation, you'll see that basically what the state is doing is covered by this particular definition. Something that it's important to remember is the 90% and 75% federal contribution. These date back to October of 1972, and as many of y'all would know, for the design, development, and installation of systems, the federal government provides 90% of the cost, and then they provide 75% for claims processing and for information retrieval systems. CMS also talks about contracting, and specifically in the development of MMIS systems, obviously the state in many instances doesn't have the technical expertise on staff to develop a system, so you tend to go out and find a vendor, a private contractor, to develop the system for you, and in many cases they may also act as the fiscal agent and actually operate the system. Let's talk a little bit about North Carolina. The original contract, which is still ongoing, which dates back to, Angie, what, the early 80s, maybe? Okay, 1977. EDS had the contract. They were acquired by Hewlett-Packard in 2008, and they continue to operate the legacy system as the state works to develop a new system. However, the state realized that the old system they had didn't meet what they needed going forward, so a new contract was awarded in April of 2004 to ACS. The plan completion date was June of 2006, but that started slipping over time. There were issues with the compatibility of the system with the one they brought in from Mississippi, and there were some other concerns. So finally, in May of 2006, the state CIO at that time, George Bacolia, notified DHHS that the project would be suspended if they were unable to resolve the issues they had surrounding the project. DHHS didn't wait for the state CIO. They went ahead and terminated the project in July of 2006. ACS obviously was not happy about this, and so they ended up settling for about $10 million in 2007. So after that, second RFP process and a new contract was awarded to CSC in 2008. Originally, it was scheduled to go live last month, but there were issues that have resulted in it now hopefully going live around March of 2013. Some of these issues revolve around changes. I sat down and counted the changes in a document that DHHS submitted to the General Assembly. I counted 281, so it's approaching 300 changes. Some of these are federal and state mandates that the department had no choice but to make, that they became aware of after the project began. Cost has also increased. Now, the cost that I'm showing here is what's called total cost of ownership. It includes the complete cost of the contract plus 5 years of operations and maintenance. The current cost that DHHS has reported as shown here is about $619 million, which includes that 5 years of operations and maintenance, but it does not include two contracts that have to be still renegotiated as a result of the schedule slippage. So going back and comparing the current MMIS project to what I showed you earlier about what constitutes a successful project, We have seen some schedule slippage since the project began. The project is being re-baselined. They have a new schedule now based on a completion date in 2013, and hopefully they'll be able to stay with that schedule and complete on time. Talked about scope changes. Again, these have been fairly significant and have obviously extended the project. One thing that DHHS has done is they have broken the project into discrete individual projects, allowing them to better manage pieces, which is one of the things that the Harvard study talks about being necessary for a good project. In terms of their team, they have had the same state leadership throughout the process, going back to the original ACS contract. Obviously, they've had different vendors, and they've actually had some turnover in the CSC leadership since CSC assumed responsibility for the contract. Need to talk a little bit about turnover. This has been an ongoing challenge, some of it beyond the department's control. Their 12-month total as of last month was 23.56%. But it's something that the department is tracking very closely. Dan Stewart asks about it at every meeting that I attend. And one of the things that's driving this is obviously lots of states are in a situation where they're having to make changes in anticipation of the Affordable Care Act, or there are a number of new MMIS systems coming online. So all of these states are competing for these people who know how to program and operate these systems. So some of them tend to jump from state to state as they get better offers. So if you're the vendor who is developing the system, you're constantly fighting that, and you're constantly having to fight ways to find ways to motivate and keep people. But again, that's something that the department is really doing a good job of tracking at this point. Making sure that it's a business endeavor is very important, and I'll ask Ms. Sly to talk about the role of the Division of Medical Assistance in the development of this particular MMIS system. Already talked about readiness to go live. That's something that the state CIO's office and ITS focuses on, and so they're constantly aware of where a project is. In fact, currently, the project was listed as red because of schedule slippage, but it should be green once the new schedule is approved by OSBM. Is that correct? Okay. So what has the General Assembly done to get involved in this process? Basically, they included a special provision that laid out specific requirements for MMIS over the next couple of years, and the requirements are listed here. A couple I'd like to highlight. They did provide detailed cost information at the beginning of August, which I'm sure that Ms. Sly will go to in more detail. One of the things that the General Assembly is starting to do on a regular basis is require private counsel for large contracts. And this has turned out to be a good thing, because what you pay for the private counsel, you're more than paid back for in mistakes that you don't make in developing your contract, because what they do is go out and find people who are actually subject matter experts in negotiating with these vendors. I talked about a revised schedule. I think that slipped to September 1st is when we actually got that, but there is a revised schedule now. They continue to make quarterly progress reports and to submit reports on the individual projects that I talked about. In addition to requirements for DHHS, there are also requirements placed on the State Chief Information Officer in Section 1029, which are listed here. The final requirement is that if any part of the project goes red, the state CIO is required to report immediately. That was done in August of this year. Again, I am told that the project should go green with the implementation of the new schedule. And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, pending your questions, this completes my portion of the report.
Why don't we hear from Ms. Sly next, and then perhaps that might answer some questions that are on people's minds at the moment, and then we'll have a question-answer session. Ms. Sly?
Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. No, does that fit me?
If you can wait just 1 minute while we hand out your slides.
Chairman Pate, yes. While the materials are being passed out to the members, we do want to take just a moment to recognize Representative Marilyn Avila in the back over here. Representative Avila is visiting with the committee today, and we are very pleased that with my moving into Chairman Barnhart's role, and with we all regret his leaving the General Assembly. We'll miss him sorely. Representative Avila will be a co-chair on the House Subcommittee, Appropriations Subcommittee on Health and Human Services, with Chairman Burr. So we welcome her willingness to step up and serve, and you don't know what you're getting yourself into. I guess that's what the best advice I can say.
Did I have a choice?
No.
With that, Ray Partee, we shall, and thank you very much for agreeing to serve. We'll now go to Ms. Sly.
Thank you. My intention today is to give you a program update for the MMIS replacement program. I plan to cover a basic program overview, which will give you some background to some of what Carlin spoke to earlier with respect to some of the IT requirements on the project when the project was restarted. I will give you an update on the schedule, and in that update, I will discuss the new timeline and the delays and the slippage. I will also provide an implementation update, which will update you on the progress of the project so far. I will give you a financial update, which will talk about the impact of the delay and Amendment 2 and how that has impacted our budget. I will go over MMIS program risks, and then we will have general questions. And as usual, you're free to ask questions anytime that you see fit as a part of this presentation. The MMIS program, I wanted to make you aware that it was funded by CMS, and it's primarily funded with 90% dollar. I think it equates to something like 87.7% overall that we get in federal match to support the project. CMS has and continues to offer its support to the project. After the ACS contract was terminated, one of the things that CMS and ITS did is they came together with the state to look at ways that they could improve the project and ensure its success as a part of a re-procurement. As a result of that, our state CIO made several mandates with respect to change. One of those mandates was that the project be broken down into pieces and subcomponents, and Carlin addressed that in her presentation. As well, they also mandated that additional staff support be brought in to help lead the project. They required that a separate director for IT activities be hired, and we actually hired that person and brought that person on board. The person who's actually directly responsible for the IT side of the development is Paul Guthrie. In addition to that, to assist with the procurement, we brought in a procurement specialist from the Department of Defense who helped to oversee the procurements. Right now, as a result of that, the replacement program is made up of 6 business initiatives, 5 procurements, and 3 additional projects that have been added along the way. And I, what I will do is outline what those projects and those procurements are. The six business initiatives were the MMIS business rules, and what was decided in conjunction with CMS is that because the system had been primarily operated by the same vendor for almost 30 years, the state did not have fully documented all of its business rules, its edits, and audits. So the federal government funded a separate business project to analyze and document the business rules. They also funded an additional project for provider type and specialty. What we currently have is a provider type and specialty solution around IDs for providers, even though we're crosswalking it now under the NPI rule, where we have a lot of intelligence actually embedded in the provider ID number. The federal government no longer allows that, and we developed a provider type and specialty project to come up with a strategy to avoid that. The next project was the Health Choice Business Rules. One of the things that we realized is that health services regulations works hand in hand with our MMIS. And it was important that we try to find some way to get some funding to support the DHSR activities. The current DHSR activities are funded primarily with 100% state dollars. And what the feds approved was for us to do a business analysis and look at our business processes. And if we would in turn make a justification for the additional funding, they agreed to support the project at 50% match. So that saved the state another 50% on their state contribution. One other project that was mandated by the Office of the State Controller was driven by a concern that they had with the department's accounts payable and receivable solution. And its legal structure, the Office of State Controller mandated that more automation go as a part of that solution. So we added another business initiative to look at the MAS, the Medicaid Accounting System, and to make those changes as recommended by the Office of the State Controller. The DHSR Business Process Modeling Project, which I discussed earlier, and then the Artifacts Review Project simply was a way of getting all the artifacts necessary for vendors to review to ensure a successful reprocurement. The project also included five competitive procurements, one of which is the replacement MMIS. You're already aware of that. Carlin mentioned that. Another procurement was the testing contract. The state wanted, per CMS's guidance, to get additional staff to augment the testing process of the development, and a $5.6 million five-year contract was awarded to SysTest Labs. Another requirement by CMS was for IVV, independent verification and validation. This particular group has independent oversight and QA. They report directly to the program sponsor, Dan Stewart, and to the CMS regional office. This was a $2.9 million three-year contract awarded to Maximus. At the time the IVMV contract was originally let, it was originally let at the request of CMS. But now, because of new federal regulations, all large projects are required to have IVMV. Another important part of the MMIS replacement is the reporting and analytics project. Without the reporting and analytics project, the MMIS replacement solution cannot be certified by CMS. CMS requires that a fraud and abuse component exists in every MMIS solution. The fraud and abuse component is actually a part of the reporting and analytics solution. And what will happen with every MMIS solution in the nation is that once it goes live, you only receive a 50% match for operations until the system is certified. And CMS's process, as will be our process, is that once the system goes live, we will have to operate the system at a 50% match for 6 months before CMS will even consider it for certification review. Certification review normally takes about 6 months, from 4 to 6 months, During that time, you also continue to receive a 50% match. At the end of the certification, traditionally, states receive retroactive participation back to go live, provided the system was actually functional at the go live day. So that is the same predicament that the state of North Carolina will be in. And then the last project is the DHSR Business Process Automation Project. It automates major components of health services regulations. It's a $9.1 million, 26-month development contract. We're pleased to announce that this solution is actually being hosted by ITS. It's the first one of our components that will or is being hosted by ITS with optional vendor maintenance in the future. In addition to that, as we have progressed on the project, we've been asked to take on additional projects as well. One additional project was the budget and forecasting implementation. This was driven by the Medicaid program's need to actually be able to do a better job at forecasting their expenditures and their recipients and things of that nature. At the time that the project was originally started, DMA was actually managing the program with a massive number of Excel spreadsheets. And what SAS has done is it has come in with their tools and their SAS forecast server. It's my understanding that State Budget Management is also using the same software, and they've used that to develop a solution for DMA. This program was jointly managed by DMA and our office, and it is completed and under production. The MITA project, the Medicaid Information Technology Architecture Self-Assessment Project, was a mandate by CMS. We cannot, or no state can continue funding without doing this assessment. That assessment was completed in-house along with the behavioral health self-assessment. And then, of course, we're probably all familiar with ARA and the Medicaid HIT projects and the impacts that they have had. As a result of the ARA HIT incentive program, the Office of MMIS actually developed, in conjunction with the Division of Medical Assistance, the planning, advanced planning document. We helped to develop the state Medicaid HIT plan and roadmap, and that is completed. And now we are working on the Medicaid incentive payment solution. We've already started making payments to providers and to health care providers, the traditional professionals, as well as the hospitals, as they are trying to establish electronic health records. The next phase of that project, which is still under development, is the attestation phase. The first phase of the project, once it was completed, was actually transferred to DMA for further management. The next thing we're going to talk about is our MMIS schedule update. And I'd like to note that CMS stated in their approval letter for the project, or for the amendment too, as the contract is being extended, that CMS recognizes that MMIS systems are complicated, long-term IT projects involving meeting target dates that are negatively impacted by federal and state legislative change and federal and state policy changes, and we are well aware of that. The system is currently projected to go live between March 1st, 2013, and July 1st, 2013. This date change is related primarily to scope expansion. The scope expansion represents 12 months of the delay, and secondarily to schedule slippage, which relates to 6 months of the delay. The federal and state legislative changes, as well as legacy system changes, have increased the contract scope by 12 months. It was interesting that Carlin was talking about how many changes she had noted, and I just want to let you know that there are a lot more changes than that and a lot more still coming. Changes to the legacy MMIS, after the RFP was actually published, there were 741 changes to the legacy solution. 525 of those were for Medicaid, and 216 of those were for mental health. And you perhaps might have looked at that mental health number. Major federal regulations, which included HIPAA 5010, ICD-10, the National Correct Coding Initiative, and, of course, the all-infamous health care reform. All of these are now federal mandates. In addition, we have our state law changes. In the session law for 2010, there were 34 impacting changes, and we have not completed the assessment for the impact of change for this past session. Schedule slippage accounts for 6 months of the delay. The root cause of this delay is attributed to CSC's overestimation.
If we can interrupt you for just one moment. Chairman Lewis, you mind if I ask a question?
Sure. Go ahead.
I guess if you wouldn't mind, so I don't forget it, just expanding for a moment, you were talking about the number of changes. If you could just help me understand, I mean, it would seem to me that in a system this large, the anticipation from the beginning of the contract, I mean, when the original RFP and the original development of the contract, it would be anticipated that you would have hundreds of changes. I mean, that's just the nature of this system. Both, you know, from the federal level and from the state level, obviously there's no way to anticipate what all the changes will be, you know, looking in the out years, except that you know that those kinds of things are going to be happening. And if you can just make it help me understand why there seems to me to be such inflexibility demonstrating the system that it has cost us so much more money, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, and so much more time, in part adjusting to these changes, and I don't understand why the system doesn't, in its conception, recognize that that's the nature of what we're dealing with, and be able to operate more or address more efficiently and less costly those changes that come up.
If you don't mind, so that everyone can hear, I will not be looking at you,
that's
but addressing
fine.
The microphone. Yeah. I think it's important for us to have a clear delineation between the development side of the project and the project once it is implemented. The main reason for replacing the MMIS solution is because coding as it currently exists is inflexible because it is all hard coded. So in order to be able to anticipate change, we're standing up a new system where more things will be table driven. So if you decide you want to change a rate, for instance, you would just go to a table and change that rate. If you decide you want to add a new edit or a new audit, you would go to the table and you would simply make that change. That is the system that we will actually be installing. The system that we currently have now is a system that is under development. While there is always an anticipation that there will be change in any MMIS development, you can never anticipate the total amount of change. To be able to anticipate, for instance, the federal changes and health care reform, I don't know if anybody 5 years ago knew that health care reform would have passed. I don't think we could have perhaps anticipated that. While we did anticipate some change, we never anticipated the amount of change that has actually occurred.
Ms. O'Shaughnessy, do you want to comment on that at all, speak to that point or not? Maybe later. Okay. I'll let it go with that for the moment, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Please continue, Ms. Slade.
Okay, thank you. The schedule slippage accounts for 6 months, and the root cause is the overestimation of the degree of fit with the New York baseline solution. The vendor estimated a 70% code reuse. They actually realized 32%. It is interesting to note that when the vendor realized that they had overestimated the degree of fit. They hired an additional 100 staff to work on the development to offset that variation. The degree of fit was also impacted by the inclusion of 221 legacy CSRs in the technical design. And I want to digress just for a minute to explain this. The vendor originally bid on the requirements as established in 2007. After the contract was awarded in December of 2008 and the requirements gathering sessions occurred, they met with groups of individuals from the various participating divisions to document all the requirement details. In that documentation process, because some of the employees were already aware that some of the changes or requirements were stale, they went ahead and made changes to or recommended changes to the solution that reflected the department's new way of doing business. So as a result of that, 221 of those changes actually were embedded in the original technical design. As a result of the slippage and in accordance with the contract, CSC was penalized and had to pay $10 million for schedule slippage. And that $10 million represents the 4 months of slip of the 6 months attributed to CSC at a $2.5 million savings that the state was actually losing as a result of the system not coming up on time. In addition, CSC is contributing $37.5 million in additional system functionality. We also took an opportunity with outside legal counsel's assistance to make some changes to the contract. It should be noted that the original contract per session law already required that outside legal counsel review the contract. So the contract that was actually awarded to CSC had already undergone heavy scrutiny by outside legal counsel. But as a result of what happened, an amendment to and the slippage, additional changes were made to the contract. The damages cap was raised from $60 million to $90 million. The performance bond was increased from $13 million to $25 million, and then there was the inclusion of other associated legacy costs in the damages. So if the system were not to go online under this new amendment, CSC would have full liability for all state costs associated with the delay, not just for the MMIS system but for the IPRS system, but for SCHIP, purchase of medical care, and the like. Now I want to talk briefly about the MMIS implementation update. The replacement MMIS, as Colin mentioned earlier, the actual solution for the MMIS replacement has been broken up into more than 20 bills. And as a result of that, the development has been an iterative build approach that goes somewhat in line with the recommendations from the Harvard Business Review. Some major components of this and subsystems are already built, those with the asterisk beside them. The provider solution is built. The recipient solution is built. The claims pharmacy solution, prior authorization, reference, the call center, and drug rebate. Development is currently being completed on critical portions of the system. The medical claims will begin system integration testing in a couple of weeks on October 10th. The providers are all, and the financial system will begin system integration on November 4th. Medical claims, financial, and pharmacy claims are probably the hub of the entire Medicaid solution. So we will actually start major parts of the testing of that in the next 6 weeks. In addition, we are in the process of engaging providers. We have over 70,000 providers, and this will be a big change for our provider community. We are conducting provider readiness surveys. We're designing provider training. And we're also preparing for a provider operational preparedness period. And I want to speak to a minute to the Provider Operational Preparedness period, or we're calling it as an acronym, the POP period. The system will actually be ready to go live on March 1st, but the state will have the opportunity to delay that go live any time between March 1st and July 1st to ensure that the providers are ready. And what our strategy is here is to allow all of the several of the check writes that are being processed currently on the HP solution to actually be processed on the CSC solution. And our main driver for that is we are not expecting this system to pay claims as the legacy solution pays claims. We are expecting this system to pay claims in accordance with policy. In some cases, we have had policies that the department wanted to implement. However, due to the limitations of the legacy solution, they could not be implemented. So there are a number of policies that have been waiting in the wings for the new solution. So this will give the department the opportunity to work with providers and to assess a provider's remittance advice to say, this is how this batch of claims paid on the legacy solution, and this is how this batch of claims will now pay on the new solution. And it will give the department the opportunity to explain to the providers where the differences are. It will also give us an opportunity to ensure that paying to policy, that everything is paying correctly. In addition to that, we have, as a part of the anticipation of change and change continuing, we have actually added 204,915 development hours for change. So we're always thinking about change. And what we ask the vendor to do based on our new go-live date is to say to the state, how much change can we stand in the schedule and not move the date? And as a result of that, we have 204,915 hours, roughly $20 million of additional change. It should be noted that any change in excess of this CSR capacity will negatively impact the operational start date. So as we have done our best to anticipate change, our estimate and what the schedule will stand at this particular point is 204,000 hours. If it goes beyond that 204,000 hours, the date will move. In addition to that, we still have final integration testing, which will begin May 29th. SIT testing will begin July 27th, and then UAT will begin on August 29th of 2012. That's where all of the users will get more aggressively involved in the system. It should be noted that while the system has been built iteratively, there are 10 different subsystems that users are actually participating in the testing now as what we call user build acceptance testing. But the true hardcore user acceptance testing will actually start in August of 2012. Replacement MMIS, the critical success factors, now and always, first and foremost at the top of the list, is managing change. System development is nearing completion. Any change introduced going forward in our schedule presents risk to the quality of the solution that we're standing up. As a result of that, we are, as is a good business practice, as the Harvard Business Review will attest, we have to at some point freeze the system. So what we're going to do is do a system freeze in two phases. Thorough testing of a completed system will be required by CSC and state testers. And there will be extensive full system testing beginning in May of 2012. Critical to the control to changes in the system as we move forward are the freezes that I discussed. One is we're calling the soft freeze. During the soft freeze period, which is 180 days prior to UAT, or March 2012, only small changes will be made to the system. And what we're defining as a small change is a change that will take less than 40 hours of work to design, implement, and test. If it takes more time than that, it will impact the system's go-live date. The next freeze we're calling a hard system development freeze. During this period, changes are only made through an exception process. In this particular case, it would have to be a federal or legislative or state legislative mandated exception. 90 days prior to UAT or May 31st, 2012, and this will require DHHS and CSC's executive management approval. Critical to achieving the schedule is maintaining these soft and hard freeze dates. With respect to the replacement solution, I wanted to speak just for a minute about the CSC partnership. Normally, when you go through an amendment of this nature, there is generally a lot of infighting among the ranks on both sides and finger pointing and things of that nature. But I wanted to make you aware that we worked through the negotiation in a collaborative way. We've come out each side with a few battle scars, but we continue a collaborative working relationship. The CSC management team, as well as the state management teams, are results-oriented and schedule-driven. Project details are closely managed, and there is a renewed focus on employee retention. One of the things that Carlin mentioned, retention is a major problem for all states. I mentioned earlier that we brought in a specialist from the Department of Defense, Gordon Neff, to help us early in our project. He has a lot of experience with multi-billion dollar projects on the defense side. But unfortunately, South Carolina started their replacement solution, and we lost him as a contractor to South Carolina. In addition, we are looking forward to the fact that we have a team that is anticipatory. We want to quickly recognize risk to the schedule. We want to work effectively with the management to resolve those issues to ensure that the system will come up on time. The other major project that's a part of the MMIS, without this project's success, we will not get the MMIS replacement certified. That's the reporting analytics and analytics solution by Thomson Reuters. It is currently under construction. We are in the process of working out Amendment 2. Carlin did mention there were two other contracts that had to be amended. There are actually three other contracts that have to be amended as a part of this solution, the Thomson Reuters contract, the IBMV contract, and the testing contract. As a result of other requirements from previous state legislation, we had to incorporate some functionality for the state health plan in the reporting and analytics solution. And I'm pleased to report that that work is underway to design and develop the required data warehouse reporting solution that was mandated in the session law. And then the last project, business process automation, with the Division of Health Services Regulations, is in production for stage one, and there are eight other stages which are scheduled to be completed in 2013. Now, the financial update. I'm going to talk to you as much as necessary, as much as you'd like, about where we are with the financial portion of the project. The amended contract comparison, I don't think you can see it from there, so if you're looking at your notes, I wanted to walk through that very briefly and look at those numbers and look at the comparison between the original contract and the amended contract. The original contract started out with a 32-month, $91 million cost for development. The replacement contract now has a 50-month duration and $157 million cost for development. The original contract had 4 years of operations with one option year, which totaled together would have been a 92-month contract. And the new contract, based on the base, 4 years with one option year, would have brought the base contract total to $364 million. What I want to do is just let you look at the base contract, how the base contract appears in comparison with the original contract without any change. Then if you look at the bottom part, which is the contract additions, you can see that an additional base year of operations was added to the contract for $37 million. An additional option year was added for $38 million. The first additional year was really 37.7. And then the provider operational preparedness phase, which I discussed earlier, which will last for 4 months, will cost $6.4 million. ICD-10 and 5010 will cost $33.3 million, and bringing the MMIS 22-month contract to a total of $479.6 million. It should also be noted that HIT is also a part of this funding process, and the HIT contract will add an additional $15.2 million to the overall contract price. We're deducting the $10 million for the slippage credit, and I want to note that we've actually decided to take the credit for the slippage during the operations phase. If we take the credit for the slippage during the development phase, we have to return $90 million of that. I mean, we have to return $9 million of that money back to the feds. But if we take it during the operations phase, then we get to get the 75-25 match and get more advantage for the state. So the contract total is $494.8 million.
Ms. Slide, would you take another question from Chairman Dollar?
Just a quick question while you're sitting here going over the numbers. Looking back at the Physical Research Division's report, they indicated a current cost of $619 million. You've got $494 million there. What's the difference?
Mr. Chair, could you speak in the microphone?
Yes, I was going to ask you to get to the mic and explain that again, please.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the difference is what this shows is the cost of a contract. What was in the fiscal research presentation was the overall cost of the project, including 5 years of operations and maintenance.
Well, is that 5 years over and above the 4 and 1 year that's up on this chart?
That is the total cost of ownership for the program.
All this slide is looking at is a particular contract, their largest one.
May I add to that, sir?
Yes, please.
Originally, when I talked, I gave the program overview. One of the reasons I gave more detail about what was in the, everything that was in the program, because there are a lot of projects, some of which have already been completed, that are part of this program, not just the MMIS. So all of the costs for all of the procurements, all three of the contracts, and all the other six projects, the HIT project, all of those projects are included in that total cost of ownership.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Allred.
Yeah. For decades, we've been worried about Medicaid costs, the expansion of Medicaid, the fraud, and all of that. Give us some reason to think why right now we should feel any better about anything with all of this or not, or worse. Just tell us why we should have any feeling of happiness at all about this.
Well, I have to keep myself happy about it, and that is, I say that with all due respect. But unless you're actually working on the inside of the project and seeing the details, it's really hard to put your arm around all that has happened and all the progress that is made. When I look at the fact that we've already more than 50% completed the solution, that gives me a reason for hope. When I look at the fact that we've already brought up early operations for the provider, some of the provider components are already operational, the provider EVC. When I look at the drug rebate, and I'll discuss that later, that's another one of the early components. We've already installed the drug rebate and preferred drug list, and since it was implemented last year, we've saved over $40 million on that. That's active. Even if I could digress just for a minute also back to the ACS contract, it is not taboo for me to talk about the ACS contract. The ACS contract was able to be terminated because the department had a strong contract that allowed the state to terminate the contract and to not pay ACS any more than they were entitled to as a part of that contract. But in that contract termination negotiation, we had stood up another part of the settlement, Smart PA. And as of March of this year, the state has saved over $90 million from the implementation of Smart PA. We talk about the ACS contract, and sure, I wish that we had gone live with the ACS solution, and we did not. However, the thing that makes me feel good about it is, one, the contract withstood the test of scrutiny by a major corporation. The state settled only on what they were required to receive as a part of the contract under the terms. And in exchange for that, the state got another solution for which it did not pay, and it has received or recognized over $90 million of savings through the first quarter of this year.
When you make the statement that we've saved $90 million, compared to what?
$90 million compared to the fact that if we had not saved it, we would have been spending the state match to support it.
Yeah, further questions?
Why would we have had to have paid it anyway?
Because with Smart PA, what Smart PA is requiring for a number of drugs, and we did not have this as a part of the legacy solution, for it to have prior approval before they could be administered. Pharmacy costs is a great deal of the burden of costs for Medicaid. And we did not have that software in place. And as a result of installing that software, we were able to stop those prescriptions that should not have been filled. And as a result of that, we saved $90 million.
Question. Well, is all of this stuff, is this just in reaction to federal mandates, or why are we doing it anyway?
We're doing it because it's a good thing. The Smart PA was a good thing. In fact, in our current RFP requirements.
Wait a minute. Okay. Why is it a good thing? What's a good thing?
It's always a good thing if we can only spend money when it's necessary, if we can look at a prescription drug that perhaps should not.
No, my question to you was, why are we doing this? Because the federal government mandates it, or because we feel like it?
Are you talking about why are we doing the MMIS?
Basically, whatever we're doing. I mean, to me, you've got all this technology to deal with somebody who's telling you got to have it. We didn't always have all this, so why are we doing it now?
We're adding more technology because as our populations grow, we can't continually to do it manually. So we're going to have to add more technology to accommodate it.
Well, I'll just ask you a question. Being the idiot that I am, why can we its population grows, why can we not continue to do it manually? Why would it not be better to do it manually and give people jobs and not have all this ridiculous expenditure that goes to make all these rich companies richer? Why not give people jobs and let people do it?
Well, now, I can't. That is a great question, perhaps, for some federal legislators, but the MMIS system is a federal mandate.
Okay. Isn't that the question I asked you a few minutes ago?
I thought you were asking me why we were doing Smart PA. So I'm
I want to know why we're doing all of this stuff. I mean, is this all a reaction to federal mandates, or is this stuff that we're doing on the local level? Or, I mean, there's so many problems with it. And what was this black swan thing that was up here? What, 200% overruns and all this stuff? I mean, how can that possibly be a good thing?
Well, I guess because I have a degree in computer science, I look at technology a little different. And this is no disrespect to you, Senator. What I'm actually trying to say is this is an age of technology. And while we probably, if you look at the fact, if we look at all the claims that we process in a year and we converted all of that into paper, it would fill this building. And while it would be perhaps a good thing in some folks' eyes to do all of that manually, I don't know if anyone would want to tackle that manually.
I can
accept that just as a general proposition, but the state population hasn't grown that much from the days when we did it manually. I mean, the state population hasn't doubled. If the state population had doubled and you had twice as many employees or twice as many forms, that would be conceivable that you could do that. I mean, I'm just making an argument because, to me, this just seems esoteric beyond belief. I don't know how you can have oversight over this. It's just overwhelming.
And this is, if I may continue to speak, this is one of the things that we're faced with because of, number one, because of federal mandate and because of state mandate. Even though we have federal changes, even at our state level, we are still implementing changes. And while it may be a good idea to say all of this should go back to manual, now I can't speak to the Medicaid population and what, not about the state population. I cannot speak to the Medicaid population and what the Medicaid population was in 1972 when the state first started doing Medicaid. Perhaps some of my counterparts can speak to how much the Medicaid population has grown. But it must be admitted that if you look at all of the doctor's offices now and the hospitals who submit everything to us electronically, if we went back to paper, we would also have to ask all of the doctor's offices and the hospitals to also all go back to paper. And if that is something that could be mandated at the federal level, then I would support it and I would continue to work with it. Now, I must admit, as you have said, it is an awesome job to try to oversee because it's almost like changing the tire on a car while you're moving. Now, it is important to note that even though the feds fund this 90%, 75%, some components 50%, they are also still constantly making changes. And they're mandating them by a certain date. They're making these changes for Medicaid, Medicare, for SCHIP, and they're saying to providers, effective this date, you have to submit this claim in a particular format. And it's the federal law, or else you can't get paid.
I'd like to make a comment.
Senator Allring, would you please hold your comments until after she needs to go ahead and complete her briefing, and then we will open the floor for pertinent questions.
Well, I wanted to make a comment.
Go ahead.
If we're doing something because the federal government is forcing us to do that, I can see that. But when you say things like the federal government is paying 75% or 90% or whatever. The federal government is broke, and they're destroying this country. 43 cents of every dollar they spend is borrowed. Most of it comes from China. I mean, this is insanity. If they're paying for it, they're paying for it with money we don't have. That's my comment.
Ms. Slapp, please go ahead with the balance of your briefing. We will have other questions at the end. Thank you.
The next slide is just the financial impact of Amendment 2 in millions. It compares the original base contract to the amended base contract and gives you an explanation of the breakdown. The difference in the original base contract and the amended base contract is only $67 million. And this gives you a breakdown of that $67 million. We have the changes or CSRs, which is $27 million. We have the legacy CSRs included in the design, $4 million. We have enhancements beyond the contract, and I won't bother to read all of those details. If someone has a specific question about it, you can feel free to ask. But that gives you a breakdown of everything that makes up the difference in the base contract. And the things that are included in that, as we previously discussed, are HIPAA 5010, ICD-10, Correct Coding Initiative, healthcare reform, and we say other because there are other things that are in the making even as we speak. There's still recent new changes required for providers. In addition, we have the state legislative session, and there are continued changes in both of those sessions. As I stated last session, there were 34 changes, and we have not completed the assessment for 2011. The MMIS funds required for state fiscal year 2011-12 is looking at a total MMIS expenditure, and the estimated state funds that are needed are $17,367,176. The state appropriation balance, July 1st, 2011, $15,213,000+. And the appropriations for state fiscal year 11-12, $3,232,304. And our estimated carry forward for appropriations for June 30th, 2012, slightly over $1 million. The funds required for 12-13, following that same scenario, the state funds that are required for MMIS, $14,097,000. The appropriations that will be carried forward from 2012, $1+ million. Appropriations that currently exist for state fiscal year 11-12 are $12 million. And the estimated cash balance on June 30th, 2013 will be a negative $1+ million. Now, speaking to the return on investment, some of this I spoke to earlier in addressing Senator Allred's question, but the supplemental drug rebate preferred drug list, $40 million has been collected through July 2011. It was implemented in May 2010. The development cost was $164,000, and the operations cost $50,000 a month. So our total investment through July was slightly under $1 million, but we have already recognized $40 million in collections through the supplemental drug rebate preferred drug list. The cost of the MMIS implementation, the state's investment, I realize this is a lot of money, and we talk about state investment. And I look at state and federal investment because it is all my tax dollar. When I look at my Beacon pay stub or check my deposit in the bank, I'm short quite a bit of money. Some of it goes to the feds and some of it goes to the state. But the state investment will be recovered in 22 months. And over the life of the contract, the state savings, after it has recouped from its investment, will be $88.9 million. That is the light in the tunnel for me. MMIS program risks. One of our biggest risks to the program is change. We're talking about change. I've had questions that have been presented to me regarding change. Change is hard to anticipate. But if we do not find a way to get a handle on our change, that is going to be the biggest risk to the success of this project. We have a CSR capacity pool of $20.1 million. Since we've negotiated the amendment, we've used almost $3 million of that for change, leaving a remaining balance to be used between now and July of 2013 of a little over $17 million. CMS is so moved by change, change on both sides, change on the federal and change on the state, that they have mandated that the state actually have a unified change control board. And they're mandating that we have a board established that looks at change on the legacy side as well as the replacement solution. And what they're requiring us to do is to assess every change. And if it's not federally or state mandated, to decide if that is a change that can be delayed until after the solution goes live. Another risk to the program is the NCFAS integration. Because of healthcare reform and the new changes on the horizon with respect to the health insurance exchange and all that we're having to do with eligibility, NCFAS had to move up the implementation of its eligibility module. We are heavily involved in the integration with NCFAS. That's mainly because of new legislation that was recently approved that said no state, that the feds would not fund for any state to have dual eligibility modules. Right now, we have an eligibility module in the MMIS solution, and we're standing up eligibility for NCFAS. If NCFAS is to receive 90% funding for its eligibility module, which is what we expect to receive, then we are going to have to descope eligibility from the MMIS replacement project. When we originally started the MMIS replacement, we knew that the eligibility module would not go live until sometime in 2014 or after. But as a result of federal legislative changes, the eligibility solution had to come online sooner. But we have a critical point of risk now with the NCFAS integration. And then another risk for us is cooperation from our legacy partners. We have had a long relationship with our incumbent vendors, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, in conjunction with the State Employees Health Plan for SCHIP. And then we've had a long relationship with EDS, HP, for over 30 years with respect to our MMIS replacement, and then for almost 10 years with respect to IPRS. Because these vendors have run our business for so long, we are still heavily reliant on a lot of them for knowledge transfer. It is critical that we get full cooperation from all of our incumbent vendors and fiscal agents to ensure that there is a successful and timely handoff of all of our files, all of our data, as well as our knowledge transfer. Are there any other questions?
Thank you for your briefing. I'll open up the floor to questions from members of the committee. Yes, sir. Senator Hartzell, go ahead.
Sure. This was handed to me, so I missed because I missed some of this presentation, but I understand that there were indicated there are three contracts to still be negotiated.
That's correct.
What are those three contracts?
One is the Maximus contract for IV&V. It's now mandated by law, and we have to renegotiate that contract to extend it and to update the terminology of that contract to include the new terminology that is now a part of the Code of Federal Regulations. Then the Thomson Reuters contract, which I previously stated that in order to certify the MMIS, we have to have the fraud and abuse solution that's a part of the Thomson Reuters contract. That has to be renegotiated. And then the recommended staff augmentation for testing, that has to be renegotiated. I will let you know that in the budget numbers that we did submit, those numbers already included estimations for the extensions of those contracts.
That, if I follow up.
Go ahead.
That was my second question. Do you have some idea of what those additional three contracts will cost?
It's less than $6 million, but that is included in the budget projections we've already made.
Further questions from members of the committee? Representative Hurley, to your right, ma'am, Ms. Sly, to your right.
Over here. Hey. I'm just not sure which project this is, so I'm just to know, is this the one where all the providers and the hospitals and people are going on to put their data in for our health information? Or can you tell me exactly what this is, and are we paying the providers the $750 to come on board, or is that why the cost is so high, or is that extra?
Okay, a part of the MMIS program is also the HIT, the Health Information Technology component. So the feds will reimburse providers for becoming meaningful users of electronic health record solutions. So in that case, we're actually, as a part of this project, processing those invoices that providers are sending us and then reimbursing them based on a 100% match from the feds for anything that they're doing with respect to the electronic health record.
Representative Hurley, second question.
Thank you. We're reimbursing them for the work that they've done. Is that correct?
If they actually install an electronic health record solution and meaningfully use it, based on the terms and conditions of the federal regulation, they get to be reimbursed 100% of that money.
Do you know how much that is right now?
It varies for each provider based on the cost of their solution and their percent of Medicaid participation. It's actually a calculation.
Representative Hurley.
Thank you. Do you have any idea how many this might involve at the end? And is it $750 per provider?
Oh, more. It would be based on how much the provider actually paid for their electronic health record solution.
Thank you.
Representative Murray.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the light at the end of the tunnel of this is cost savings. And what I want to know is what we were operating under the previous 19-20 month project when it was originally contracted, it was supposed to be about 20 months, and now it's going to be a 40 month to 44 month project. And we're 50% there, which I guess makes a little bit of sense we're 20 months into a 40-month project, and we're 50% there. That makes sense. What I want to know is where are we on cost savings in that projection? So if we're 50% through the project, have we realized 50% of the cost savings that we were originally projecting with full implementation this month? It should have been implemented this month, August of 2011. So I'm trying to get an idea on the projected cost savings. Compare that to the 20% overrun of the original contract and the 100% overrun on time. I'm trying to see how well we're doing on cost savings.
That break-even analysis is based on the new projected go-live and all the state's expenses that it is projected to incur until that time. So when I talk about the 22-month break-even, when we actually go live with the system, all of the money that the state has invested as of that date, in 22 months, the state will recoup all of its investment. At the end of the contract term, it will have saved $88 million additional.
I have a question I'd like to ask you, Ms. Slide. With the change in health care that's coming down from the federal government, how do we know of what impacts it's going to have on MMIS and other record-keeping sources like this, these plans? Do we have any sort of confidence in what changes might be coming down the pike as far that would affect a program like this in a negative or a positive manner?
Some of the changes that I have already discussed are in the health care reform legislation. When you look at NCCI, the National Correct Coding Initiative, that is a part of health care reform. When you look at ICD-10, 5010, and 5010 is necessary for us to actually implement ICD-10, health care reform will not be successful in part if ICD-10 is not implemented.
Further questions? Senator Blake.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Three. Then that we were going to have a new program talking about. We have billions, I'm afraid, of dollars trying to get a technical program in place to do what we're talking about today. And I'm sitting here listening to you, poor person, about a system that will not work. I'm talking about overall. 5 years from today, we'll still be apologizing, trying to defend why a program won't work, because it won't work, because it's so convoluted that it will just never work. And I'm sorry about that. Good luck. Thank you.
Chairman Dollar, you have a question?
Thank you. I have several questions. And let me just preface a couple of things that I'm going to ask you about by letting you kind of know where I'm coming from on this. I watched the Beacon Human Resources project be implemented. And as many of the people here in this room know, that's been nothing short of a disaster as far as I'm concerned. The system went into place. It was not properly tested and field tested before it was fully implemented. It created all sorts of problems and headaches and probably cost us more to operate that system than it than it has ever saved, and they still don't have all the kinks out of it. This system, obviously, I think is actually quite a bit larger in scope than that project. And there was an audit done, for example, on the Beacon project, and I'm just curious. One question I have is I'm curious, have y'all looked at the audit that was done on the Beacon project and the human resources side of health and human, well, for the entire state, and obviously it affects health and human services, your department. Did y'all look at that audit and glean anything that you've been able to use in terms of things not to do or things to in as you're trying to implement this project?
If I could be very candid with you, when Beacon first started, it was recommended by some that we pattern ourselves after the Beacon Project, which we elected not to do. Big projects are hard. They are hard across the board. They're hard because things are changing. And one thing about the Beacon Project, fortunately, the payroll changes are not happening as frequently as Medicaid program and policy changes are. But anytime there is an audit, not just in our state, but in other states, as in the case of Washington, who just went live with a new solution, we go back and we review their lessons learned. That's a requirement for us, to review the lessons learned. So when it comes to lessons learned, it's hard to kind of necessarily define what you read in an audit, because sometimes audits reflect the opinion of the person who's doing the audit. But what I like honing in on are lessons learned. When a group who works on a project steps back and says, this is what we did right, and this is what we did wrong, and these are the things that we can do better. And we do look at those things and try to implement those.
Let me move on to something else. I understand that Thomas Reuters is selling their healthcare business. So what will be the impact on MMIS since you're looking at having them come in and take a review of this project with that the pending sale of that business?
That's a very good point. They have they came to the state several months ago to apprise the state of the fact that they were interested in selling the healthcare arm, which is not the first time that that arm of the business has been sold. But what they have committed to us per the contract, we have a very, very strong contract with Thomson Reuters with the help of the Attorney General's office and outside legal counsel. And what we did is we actually put Thomson Reuters on notice about the sale. They cannot even sell it as a part of the state's contract without the state having the opportunity to move forward with the contract or to terminate it.
Okay. Let me ask you another question. In terms of the you were talking about changes with the change control board. How many changes have been disapproved by that board thus far?
Well, this is a new board that's just being stood up as a part of Amendment 2, so the Joint Change Control Board has not started functioning yet. They will start functioning effective October 1st.
Okay. Can you give us an estimate? Let me ask one other financial question real quick, and then I'll ask a related one. When you were responding to Representative Murray, you're talking about a savings within the context of his question of $88 million. Is that state and federal money or the state's piece of that?
That's the state. The total savings, state and federal, is in excess of $140 million.
Okay. How much money, do we have an estimate of how much money would be at risk or will be at risk during the time frame that you talked about where we're only going to be receiving 50% reimbursement from the federal government? In other words, it sounds like to me that we really have to, and you correct me if I'm wrong, we really have to make sure that we get this right within that time frame. Otherwise, we're not going to be reimbursed at 90%. We're going to be reimbursed at 50%, and we're not going to be able to recoup those additional dollars. So do you have an estimate of how much money there is at risk in that piece with the federal government?
Well, the operations cost, which is traditionally reimbursed at 75% on an annual basis, will be in the neighborhood of $38 million, that one component. So if I look at the MMIS contract and the annual operations cost of $38 million, just from that component, we will only be getting 50% reimbursement for that.
Well, is that so $38 million is the total figure that is at risk in that period of time?
There will be more at risk based on how many employees are working on MMIS at 75-25, because once we stand up the new solution, the IT world of Medicaid will certainly be reshaped as a result of the implementation of this new system. We haven't got there yet, but I can tell you for the vendor match part, the operational cost is in the neighborhood of $38 million annually, and we will only get reimbursed for 50% of that.
And it could be
to 75%.
And it could be substantially more than that with other potential costs during that period of time if the department doesn't perform with the system as we're telling the federal government that we will at this point.
I won't say substantially, because for every, when it comes to the actual payment of the claim, the feds will still pay the claim at its regular match rate, based on the FMAP. But it's only the operations, the system's operations component, that they will only pay 50% because the system is not deemed fully operational until they have certified it.
Let me ask a quick question about testing. One of the concerns that I think is out there, and I know you mentioned testing in your overview, but just to make sure I've got a fair understanding of that, have you been, as you've built the system to the current point and prior to the final, you know, live implementation, are you trying to take, you know, either a smaller division or smaller programs and really, really run and test the system to make sure that it works? I mean, that was, just going back to Beacon for a second, in their scenario, they had the opportunity. They were actually, they had some smaller agencies in state government that had offered to be a test case where they would run that HR system instead of PMIS in a smaller agency to try to get out some of the kinks and problems that may have not otherwise been anticipated. Obviously, this scenario is a little different, but I guess the question is, are you going to be testing, let's say, with a narrow group of vendors, for example, to make sure that all of the kinks are worked out prior to the broader implementation dates that you've got?
Even though they are, you make a good point, and even though they are different, they do have a parallel areas where we can realize synergy. We will have state testers from the participating divisions. We currently have. We have a cadre of testers from SysTest Labs. Providers will also be involved in the testing. One good thing that I can't say we learned it from Beacon because we were already doing it as a part of our plan. With the iterative build process, for instance, when the provider module was completed, business users actually came in and physically tested, began what we call user business acceptance testing of that solution. So as we are incrementally building the system, it is actually going through user business acceptance testing. In the next phase, when we actually, and that is aside from any regression testing or all the technical testing that goes on, but I'm talking about more from the user standpoint, because those are the ones, once the system goes live, that says this system is not functioning as it should. In addition to that, we will have user acceptance testing, which I talked about earlier. We have providers who have already agreed that they're going to participate in user acceptance testing with us. So we will have providers going through an extensive 4-month period where we're actually testing the system hard and fast. And we will not just be testing the system, we will be testing the system with the state's data. In addition to that, once the system has actually been deemed fully operational by the vendor, we have another chance at it because we're going to test it again through the provider operational preparedness period because we want to be sensitive to the providers. I know that we've had an influx of Medicaid providers, but by and large, even though Medicaid is big business in some ways for some people, it is hard in some of our areas to get Medicaid providers. So we want to make sure that we're protecting their interests by allowing them to participate in a parallel process where they will run a batch of claims through the HP system. They will run that exact same batch of claims through the CSC replacement solution, and they will get to compare apples to apples and help us see if there are any major discrepancies.
I won't ask any more questions, but, Mr. Chairman, if I might make just a couple quick comments. I think one of the areas, you were mentioning vendors. I know that there are a number of vendors who had problems with just making, I'll give you an example. I know of one vendor who, a long-time provider of services, no problems, quality, problems with the services they provided. They were trying to make a name change in the system, and it caused them to get kicked out of the system. I mean, it just went on for months and months and months. They had to hire a lawyer, I mean, go through all kinds of things because the system couldn't adjust to the fact that they were just needing to make a name change in their company. So I'm hoping that some of those types of issues, and they crop up more often than what some people realize, will be addressed. But on the broader plane, I just think that there's probably a lot of concern, you know, in the General Assembly, you know, that the project has been delayed and delayed and delayed. It has total cost in the hundreds of millions of dollars more when you add it all up. And probably maybe my personal big concern is that we end up with a platform that is flexible in terms of the changes that it has to adapt to. And we don't end up with a platform that is obviously usable in all of the other aspects, but is also has that ability to be adaptable to the changes, because I don't see, you know, those things going away. I mean, you're always going to have new program parameters that are coming from the federal government, and we have to make adjustments too in the General Assembly. I just hope at the end of the day, whenever that is, that we have a platform that serves the purpose and can be flexible and operative.
May I speak to that, Representative?
Surely. Surely.
Thank you. It is good for us to know that the solution that is being bid, in fact, the solution that was bid by both vendors, will be a rules-based solution, meaning that you can change the rule without having to hard code. In every system, there may be some limited things that you do have to hard code because of their complexity, but the system will be rules-based. With respect to provider, more of the provider involvement now will be self-service. Providers will be able to do their applications online, will be able to work through their name change processes and upload their documentation online, making it more seamless for them to complete. Right now, in order to get a change of address, there's a lot that a provider does, and it takes some time. But under the new solution, they will be able to make those changes themselves, so they will have a lot more flexibility.
Senator Bingham, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Angeline, I realize in hearing this the complexity of how what problems that you face, and I appreciate the fact that we've been able to save money. I hear you saying that as the bottom line, but I guess my question would be, how would you envision this committee being best to participate in what would be best in doing? Are you going to be making recommendations to, because I know with the changes that occur, I know in your office and with legislators, et cetera, and then we hear of some of the negative things is the overruns and other things. I don't quite understand how we could best participate in this process, and also I guess it also puzzles me if you could explain maybe a direction that I could move in where I could better understand this, maybe the audit process or who exactly has an oversight where, because it'd certainly be easy to make mistakes in this, and as complicated as it would be, and if you had someone coming and going, what would protect our state, especially with the number of federal amendments and other things and changes and the amount of dollars that we're spending with accounts or attorneys, et cetera, to defend positions. It just gets to be a bit overwhelming as to how maybe I'm speaking for myself because a lot of other members may much better understand this than I, but I guess I feel inadequate in understanding this whole process of auditing and checks and balances and that sort of thing.
Senator Bingham, may I direct that question to Ms. O'Shaughnessy?
Certainly.
Senator Bingham, one of the best things that y'all can do is basically continue to monitor this. They're pretty far down the road at this point. They've got the Affordable Care Act staring them in the face. Just constant monitoring to ensure that everything's staying on track is about the best you can do right now. Excuse me.
Would you like to add to that?
Yes, sir.
I do not want this presentation in any way to be anything disparaging about change, because change is necessary. And I think the thing that we can best do, or how you can best help us, when you look at change, look at the timing of the change. Let's say there's something that legislatively could be done for us to save money. Let's juxtapose that against the schedule moving and say, we're going to make this change, but let's make it effective after the new system is implemented. So some small things like that would give us some breathing room. Of course, we don't have the same leverage with the federal government that we have getting a chance to actually come and talk to you all individually. And I really appreciate the opportunity to come and present to you. It's an honor for me to be able to do it. But at the same time, I think everybody has to look at change in light of, if this change, and this needs to be applied at the federal level too, but I can't control that. I really can't control this, but since you're asking, if we can look at change in the appropriate context and look at how this change is going to impact us long term, and if we can delay that change so we can get the system implemented, then it would be easier for us to implement a system that's already up and running than to continue to make a change to something that is still being built. That's one of the biggest ways that we could be helped. And the other thing is, if I may say so, one of the things that is so hard when you manage a project this big, you have state employees and contractors who work day and night, who run long hours working on this project. It would be nice, with all of the other negative things that do have to be said, because if the whip has to be cracked, that's a good thing too. But at the same time, it would be nice if the team who struggles with this load occasionally had a kind word or a thank you.
With that, Ms. Sly, unless there are any further questions, we thank
Mr.
you.
Oh, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry.
Oh, I'd like to ask a question.
I'm sorry, Senator Rain, go ahead.
Thank you, sir. You mentioned that some of the software, I guess we would call it the software, some of these programs that were being put in were in anticipation of the Affordable Health Care Act, correct?
Some of the changes.
Yes.
Yes.
What would happen if the if ultimately the mandate to buy the insurance was struck down by the courts, and therefore it impacted that whole mandate?
Then if I will give you an example. I gave an example earlier about how we started the MMIS implementation thinking we had to build eligibility in, and now because of the federal law, it's going to all be in NCFAST. So as a result of that, we're de-scoping that component from the MMIS project. The same thing would happen if healthcare reform is stricken. If it's stricken in its entirety, then all work that we're doing would be brought to a expedient closure. And I have to say expedient closure relatively in the sense that you have some pieces that would be integrated that you couldn't necessarily just immediately stop coding that day. you'd have to bring it to a normal closure. But if health care reform is stricken down, all that work would stop.
How much money do you think we would lose because of that, that is being invested in this, or would we be losing any?
We wouldn't be losing any because when the project goes live, I have to qualify that because I'm a cards face up person. In light of the savings that we just discussed, if we invest less in development, then we would have more savings. But anything that we've already spent, that is basically served sunk money. If health care reform is overturned, I don't have any way of recovering the state dollar associated with that.
Do you have any idea how much it might be?
No, because we're still assessing the impact of health care reform. I know DHHS has PCG working on a big project with respect to that.
Well, I would just say, you know, a lot of people think ultimately it's going to be overturned by the courts, at least the mandate provision by the Supreme Court. So you're talking about making changes that are expensive to comply with that and not having any idea how much it'll cost if it's ultimately turned down by the court, Supreme Court. Is that what you're saying?
Sir, you make a good point, but unfortunately, I don't have a crystal ball, so I don't really know what will happen ultimately if it is stricken.
Well, I think this is an oversight committee. I mean, I think it would be nice for you to at least have some idea of how much money you're getting the state involved in, considering that it's just as easy, you know. Anybody can read the newspapers and know the likelihood that that's going to be stricken. Probably will be.
And while I understand your concern, from my standpoint, it currently is law. And I have to work where the law is now. And should the law be overturned, then we will govern ourselves accordingly.
Well, I still think you ought to know how much it could cost us. And I don't think it. I mean, so a bureaucrat's doing it. I mean, I haven't been asked about that, neither is the General Assembly.
And
so if you're making the decisions, you ought to know how much it costs.
But I'm unfortunately not making the decision.
Who is?
The federal government made the decision that there would be health care reform. That's out of my control.
Oh, they didn't make the decision to implement it on the North Carolina state level. You are, or somebody is.
I didn't make that decision either.
You did.
May I interrupt?
Who did make the decision?
Pardon me, Senator. It is now 3:35, and this segment was supposed to be over at 3 o'clock. I'm going to thank Ms. O'Shaughnessy and Ms. Sly for giving us this briefing. It's been very informative, and thank you so much. I'm sure we'll ask you to come back again.